quiet.
Yes.
Yeah, I remember, I've been quoting that, and I used it actually in a lot of my awareness of my work.
Oh. Do you remember what the quote was?
Well, it was about what you were talking about here, to do with movement.
Okay.
And to do with, there's like, as it were, seven parts of the brain that are active when you're moving. If you're watching someone moving, four of those parts are also active.
Right. We kind of continued, guys, so if that's right. This is an extended consciousness thing that a quote had permeated from before.
I was just saying that I realised that for the last 4 years I've been quoting Dan from having heard him on the radio talking to A.S. Byatt when they were discussing, was it the Festival of the Mind?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, this idea that, as in my very pedestrian way, I reduced it to this, if you're watching someone moving, and they're dancing or they're playing football, and there are, say, seven parts of their brain that are active, and then if you're watching them, actually four parts of the same parts of the brain in you are active. So there's this extraordinary sort of intersubjective, interphysical thing that's happening when we watch people moving. And movement itself is, the brain and the body are as Damasio says, as I understand it, are very connected. I mean, we can't really separate them in his,
right,
him.
And it's inevitable. And I think the other nice thing about it is, and that's what, I mean, the point about these mirror neurons is that they're, firstly, you're not aware of them. Secondly, you can't control whether they happen or not. But thirdly, more interesting, the movement control bit of you is active even when you're not moving.
Wow, I didn't know that
bit. Because, and that's how we can do it. So the dancers are in the brain scanner. They're lying still, but we can measure their movement control brain. And that's, you know, that's what you're saying, that when you're watching someone move, or even imagining them move, that the bit of your brain whose principal job it is to control your movement is active. You're sort of prefiguring, right, in your head.
Yeah,
what it is.
But it's also Damasio talks about this tipping point of this thing, what you're talking about, when you don't feel what you're feeling until you feel it, that in fact we're feeling and sensing so much in a huge, like, infinite way that we're not conscious of. It's only when something becomes, when it comes to sort of like a like the tip of an iceberg that's popping above the water, the meniscus of the water, and it's like, oh, I feel hungry now, I feel lonely now.
Yeah.
But there's a huge sort of sea, a sort of miasma of feelings that are active all the time.
Yeah. I'm less interested in consciousness than most of my friends. That's not true, but than most of my neuroscientific friends. I don't think consciousness is that interesting. But if it is interesting, it's exactly what you just said. And if you think, I mean, so consciousness is this, as it were, single stream, you know, the me now thing. For the sake of, well, I don't know if that's true or not, but that's one definition. And it seems to me that consciousness is kind of inevitable, in the sense that if we were aware of all of this other stuff all the time, we could never get anything done.
Well, sure.
I mean, it's necessary that we filter out.
I think if you are creative, then it's a relief when you hear scientists kind of offering an idea that you would doubt to assume could be real.
Right.
I think that's why there's this interest between science and artists, because there's so much uncertainty in being in any creative endeavor. And in science, there's somehow an idea that beyond where you are, there is concrete information.
But it seems so. I'm kind of terrified at the thought that somebody who's as fabulously creative and successful in the creative domain as you are would need,
by the way, I want to say that I think we should have a new communism where the salaries of scientists are distributed amongst artists and filmmakers.
Well, indeed, and I think that would be a good idea.
Not only because there's just no money. That's so true, that there's just no money.
No, it is true. And what it means, I mean, you know, okay, so, and how that makes people in different domains feel about their work and how it's valued is kind of important and sort of upsetting to me in a way. You know, but again, the idea that one should start, and I don't know if you think it's like a modern phenomenon or not, that an artist would need legitimate, and perhaps it's just artists very needy and they just need, I mean, as people are, need legitimized, take comfort where they may.
Right? I don't
as
think
science offers comfort, they will take the comfort of certainty. Oh, you mean this thing I've always known about the fact that consciousness is just the tip of experience and the rest is there, but I'm just not aware of it? You mean that's true? That's not what, of course, is fucking true. You've known it all along. Why would it be truer because some dumbass scientist purported to show it with a Mickey Mouse experiment? Do you know what I mean?
You've known it
to be deeply true all along.
Yeah, I do think that, I think artists develop quite an arrogance as a survival mechanism, possibly, because you have to kind of decide that what you are wanting to explore, you're going to stick with. And in fact, you've got to be a little bit outside. I think that, you know, now it's also career orientated. I'm old fashioned in that I sort of follow things that matter to me or that I'm curious about, that I want to understand. And I mean, I don't consider that I have a successful career in that sense, because, you know, it's very hard for me to get funding for anything that I'm doing.
It's funny. I mean, the people one aspires to be, as it were, that one's role models. There was a guy called Dick Passingham in Oxford, professor, someone I looked up to, you know, beyond almost any other scientist. And then he didn't get his program grant renewed, right? So he was approaching retirement, and he basically was on the point of shutting down the lab because the funding got cancelled. And, yeah. You know, there's Russell.
I mean, it's really all okay, this, because in the sense that you were talking about dancers, and one of the choreographers that I've worked with on a few projects is Alain Platel, and he's recently done some work that's kind of been very emotionally orientated, mm-hmm. and suddenly his funding is kind of being restrained, and, we're not sure about what you're doing now. And so, you know that where the money comes from, it comes with certain provisos, certain agendas, you know, and in fact, the state can often be the least, dictating in mm-hmm. in some ways. Mm-hmm. So that kind of confirmation that might come from outside, that money might come, comes with certain restrictions. And it's interesting to see the fear that is involved.
Sure. But again, without being funny, do you think that fear is kind of a necessary part of the creative process? Or do you think that if there were...
I mean, the fear of money giving institutions that want to reconfirm a certain set of ideas that don't want things that have questions in them. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm more interested by the idea of education. If education is you go to a place where these are things that you don't know, that mm-hmm. there's going to be doubt, there's going to be uncertainty, there's going to be a space of paralysis, possibly. And that's the space that, you know, that can't at all costs be entertained by television.
Right.
It has to always start from the basic information telling you, again, what you sort of already know a lot mm-hmm. of the time.
Mm-hmm. But I just wonder whether, you know, I mean, I don't want to have a conversation about funding of the arts exactly.
Yeah, sure.
But just this question of whether the kind of hunger, the uncertainty, is creatively productive. Or would it be better if, we were in this Elysian world where all food and all needs
I think it's just unavoidable. I think anxiety is unavoidable. So you just have to learn not to be frightened of it.
Why do you make films about dancers? That was one of my questions. Because I love working with dancers for lots of reasons. But I wonder what's interesting to you as a filmmaker about them.
Well, it started for me as the whole of my work is completely unplanned. In what I've done is things happen. I encounter people that I'm interested by or that I feel I'm going to learn something from. And when I came across Michael Clarke, when I used to work with Peter Greenaway...
Well, he had a complete triumph in Edinburgh last week. Yeah, and he's coming to London. Must see, right? Yeah. The people I know who were at this thing last week just said it blew their minds.
Yeah, well, Michael is, of course, an extraordinary dancer, has an amazing physique and a technique from his classical ballet training. But actually, I was always also fascinated by how he thought and how what he did affected how he processed ideas and language, or how he was really cautious with words. Like, he approached words like, you know, as if they were a ballet technique that you would have to use very carefully, perfectly, or not at all. It would take him like a year to write a letter.
Is it worth briefly telling those who don't know who he is, just in the sort of situate him in the culture and the world kind of thing? You'll know much better.
Yes, well, he was always dubbed the bad boy of ballet because he was he came from the Royal Ballet School. He, in fact, was Scottish and had trained as a classical Scottish dancer and then got picked up when he was around 11 or 12 to train at White Lodge at the Royal Ballet School. And then they were all excited that he was going to be this solo dancer at the Royal Ballet. And in fact, he was more interested in popular culture, in rock music. And he didn't join the Royal Ballet. He set up his own company. And he sort of broke the mold and he took risks. And he had this kind of...
He took heroin.
Well, then he took heroin, interestingly, after he had made all his work. Like, he got to a point when he was about 28... when he had his big successes at the Sadler's Wells, and then he had this big company around him and this dependency of other people's lives on you. Mm-hmm. And I think for someone who's an artist in that sense, that's a paralyzing thing. You're suddenly running a business. So he had to somehow just destroy it all. Mm-hmm. And so I think by becoming a heroin addict, he made the choice, he worked to become a heroin addict. You know, you have to go through... sort of, you know, several months of being sick and...
Right. That's not something you just do. I mean, you really have to be committed to that.
Yeah, he was committed to it in a sort of slightly half like a creative experiment, half because he was very kind of identified with this rock and roll spirit of being, you know, like he said something which was sort of pretentious, really, I thought, but he said that he thought that he couldn't really dance to Heroin, the song by the Velvet Underground, if he hadn't done heroin.
Right.
He was only 28 when he, so, you know, I think he's sort of 20 years later, he's like, geez.
I guess really can dance to that song.
I can really dance.
That's cool. But did you not get a sense of those who were here, where Jeanette was talking about, you know, what would have happened at this turning point where she became successful but wasn't old yet? And, you know, what we know that she could just start talking at conferences and so on. And I do wonder, especially if success comes early, for those of us who haven't been that kind of publicly successful, it's much easier. But, you know, if you are very successful very young, it must be this weird sense of anxiety about future productivity and what your status means and comfort and all sorts.
Yeah, I think that's like, well, you have to know, you have to kind of know like where your honey is, you know, you have to sort of be, you have to honour that part of yourself and you have to, I mean, that's why psychoanalysis is a fantastic project, which I think everybody should involve themselves in. Because, yeah, I do, because you don't need all have to go to Susie Orbach necessarily, but, you know, you just as a sort of system of thinking, as a way of approaching thinking, because what psychoanalysis encourages you to do is to sort of be attentive to, like, stupid thoughts, small thoughts, the edges of your of where ideas seem or where you, what you believe you think is clear, where things are unclear, and then sort of excavate them.
There's a Woody Allen joke, isn't there, where he's arguing with his accountant about how to write down his psychoanalysis expenses, and he wants to put them down as a business expense.
Yeah.
And his accountant says that he has to put them down as entertainment. And so, in the end, they compromise and call it a religious donation.
That sounds good, yeah.
Which is about funny. But does that mean... That, yeah, go on.
But what did you want to talk about dance in terms of...
Well, yeah, so I was going to ask, when you make a film about Michael Clarke, is that a film about dance, or is that a film about tortured artist, you know, is about his artistic curve, or is there something about interesting about dancers per se?
Yeah, for me...
unsatisfying, it seems to me, was about watching dance, especially on television, but even also on a big screen. It's a very, very difficult medium to capture, in a way, perhaps that theatre isn't, although a little bit, but even
it's
worse
a lot to do
theater.
With space. It's a lot to do with the registering of space. And, you know, cinema developed in its earliest... in the first 30 decades of its existence in the 30s and 40s, a whole grammar of how to reconstruct space for the viewer. It was
Can you give us an example of that?
Well, it's to do with, like, for instance, you know, if I was to block the camera space here, how I would work with your sightline seeing me, and I might frame you seeing me like this, and then the reverse shot of me is a headshot, and then a view over here of the group, so that when it cuts together... You give it the orientation, the perceptual orientation to the person watching it. And you know, Ernst Gombrich and I think was it Penrose and people were very interested. And the Russian cinema theorists were very preoccupied with how we reconstruct space in cinema. And I think it's a very, it's the for me, the really crucial part of cinema. And that grammar is, you don't have to work with the grammar all the time, but I think it's important to know why that grammar is makes cinema exciting, because we do then imagine ourselves in these spaces.
This is the bit of the conversation I really hoped we'd have. So can we hold the dance thing? Can I ask you a couple of questions about that, just out of interest?
Yeah.
Is that grammar universal? So you mentioned the Russians, right? Or I don't know, the Chinese. Or, you know, is it that there are these conventions about how you would block out this space as a Western filmmaker, but a Russian filmmaker would say, oh, no, we do, you know, we would do it this way and the Chinese wouldn't get it at all? Or do you think there's something universal about the grammar of blocking and angles of film?
Well, I think that culturally there's become a kind of strong, because of the sort of dominance of Hollywood, there's become a strong sort of ground level of how to construct space, which now Hollywood doesn't do. I mean, if you go to see a film like the Bourne Identity films, he's an English filmmaker, they're very exciting, they're very kinetic. Cinema's developed much more towards a sort of kinetic sense of montage and movement and drive and propulsion through that. And
that's different now than it was 20 years ago.
Grammar
that evolves.
Yeah, the grammar's evolving all the time. And there's one filmmaker from Taiwan called Hu Shaoshan, who is, you know, in terms of film, you know, authors, he's very important. Although, of course, you know, you'd be very lucky to see one of his films here. But you know, what he does with space and observation is really exciting and very inventive. And you know, he's very much dwelling on objects in space, people, you know, there's a relationship between choreography and film editing in space.
Right.
So I think space for me is the, and how we consider, how we feel ourselves to be in space is a very important part of our subjective experience.
So I think there's a whole research project here, which one day I'd be really interested to kind of do or fund, which is, I'll tell you a quick story about saccadic suppression. And then I'll ask you if it's the same in how you edit films. So saccadic suppression. Imagine if you took a video camera, all right, and you made it move like your eyes do. Okay? So if you watch someone's eyes or you think about your own eyes, they dart around all over the place. They fixate on things and then they saccade to other things. And if you took a video camera and you made it do those moves, what you'd see would be some still shots and then some whoosh, 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 whoosh. And in fact, I mean, it's early in the morning, right? But you can do it yourself gently. If you close one eye, very gently push the other eye with your finger. You can actually do that. Very gently, just push it. You see the world shakes. Is that clear? You close one eye and push the other one very gently with your finger, and the world shakes. Just gently tap it. Yeah?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Tapping it,
now,
yeah.
that's because your eye's moving and the world seems to shake, except your eye's moving the whole time.
Yeah.
So why is the world not shaking when your eye moves? And the answer is partly because of saccadic suppression. You switch off the camera while the eye is moving, and then you switch it on again when it's fixated.
Right.
You do that naturally, because otherwise you'd be perceiving all the shifts, the jolts.
Yes,
okay?
Yes.
So actually the visual experience you get from your eye
is edited.
Is jump
time.
Cuts.
Mm.
Okay, jump, 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 jump.
Mm.
And I was really interested for a period in whether, you know, the use of jump cut versus fade in cinema. Well, there's a grammar about that, isn't it? Jump cut is continuity of time.
There's
and
something
a fade.
Missing, there's time missing.
Exactly,
yeah.
And then a fade is kind of, that's a different scene. So whether the fact that you can use jump cuts is because of saccadic suppression. In other words, do our brains understand that grammar? Because it's the way that we build
vision. Yeah, it's mirroring
vision
how we understand space anyway. Yeah.
Mm. So I don't know whether the time, you know, how frequently you can cut in cinema without it seeming weird, has that got anything to do with how
well, there
frequently
are so many,
move our
there are so
eyes
many
and,
factors
you know,
involved yeah. in how long you can hold, you know, a shot for, how slowly paced things can be, and it's not.
There's
to
no
do
manual though, right? I mean, do you just know it, or how do you know when to cut? I don't know.
Well, I mean, you know, it's a very subjective thing ultimately, but it does, you know, there's also factors of what you're exposed to, for me, there's certain films that have really influenced me, and it's a lot to do with something before even cutting. It's to do with the tonality of a piece or a subject, or what's the sort of atmosphere of it, I can't even find a word for it, but all I can say is it's a sort of a tone. It's a kind of an attitude, to use a dance term. And so once I've got that, once I've felt that from the material, because I make documentaries, so I have really no control over what I'm shooting most of the time. Mm-hmm. The only control comes through the relationship with the subject. And then, you know, after that, it's time unfolding, which is endless. So then you realise how incredibly compressed a film is. So then how you choose to select that, or for me, is the starting point is what's the attitude that I want to sort of throw against the audience. I mean, the audience are crucial to me in editing. The audience, the cognition of the audience is always something that I'm playing with.
Have you seen The Thing Upstairs yet?
Yes, I have, yeah.
People presumably have seen The Thing. I mean, it's a really weird process up there, it always seems to me. I was thinking about it in terms of filmmaking as well, because there's a kind of big piece of kind of music that's being made, and then there's lots of little actions that are taking place. And if you get fixated on the little actions, this guy with the stopwatch and the thing and the hitting, then you can get very locked into that.
Yeah.
And what Jem's piece, it seems to me, does rather beautifully is to make it clear that that is part of a thing that's going for 1,000 years.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, I think that's really cool. But I always I'm always amazed by filmmaking in the sense that you're obsessed with little things that don't take much time. I think we're on to the swigging from the bottle thing.
Yeah, you know, this has been...
You get a very dilute coffee if you you're focusing on very, very short time scale things and in the shoot and in the edit, but a film can take 3 months, a year, 3 years, 10 years to make. And the thing that's always a complete mystery to me is how you can retain a sense of the movement of a film, you know, over those kinds of time scales. You'd be shooting in reverse order. You know,
you mean for feature films when you...
Yeah, but also perhaps even documentaries. I just can't imagine how you can keep the 1 hour thing in your head over the 3 years.
Well, I think with the thing about editing, and this is a sort of to do with changes in technology. I mean, I worked on Final Cut Pro. I edit my material myself because it's now become more like writing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not that different to how a writer might imagine and construct things, except you've got this physical film material. It's also... I've lost my thought. What were you
I just can't imagine how you keep the small thing in your head big, long arc of...
Yeah, I remembered now what I wanted to say was that I made a film with a very brilliant editor who I learned a lot from. And he had started editing with, you know, sellotape, splicing newsreel very quickly. He was even wore like braces and he was like 65, which, you know, seemed to me then kind of be quite old. And but he had this sense of the physicality of time that you had before digital mm-hmm. editing techniques. So, you know, you have to know the material very well. You have to form it from a mass down. Mm-hmm. So you don't know, you can't really know in documentary editing what that reduced small part will be.
So you don't have
be.
An image of it in your head, which you're kind of, you know, like the Henry Moore quote, is it, or whoever it is, Rodin, about the sculpture being there and all you need to do is chip away the extraneous bits of stone to reveal it.
Well, it's very blurred. It's kind of, it's a feeling. It's like this kind of like, yeah, you're guided by certain things, like, you know, specific feelings. Or, you know, with me, literally, I will kind of wake up in the middle of the night with one sentence from some material that's mm-hmm. like haunting me. Mm-hmm. And I think, I really need to make sure that that goes in. I mean, I kind of try to be as open as possible to the things that seem to be important, and it's a discovery. So you start with a big amount of material. You have to be very systematic. Mm-hmm. There's no form to it in documentary. You have to create a form. So you have to say, well, you know, these bins are this material. You create a structure to this endless sprawling time, mm-hmm. and then that's the beginning of the reduction. But sort of somewhere there are invisible ropes that you're kind of helping yourself to pull up yourself up the mountain, and then you have other people's opinions and people will and how people will sit and watch a rough cut.
Must be terrifying.
Well, it's the strange thing talking about sort of intersubjective communication mm-hmm. is that I find that you can watch a rough cut with four people in the room and you know exactly what they think. Mm-hmm. So by the end, you don't. Strangely, something is almost telepathic. You're very sensitive to how people respond.
Yep.
To wait, the choices that you've made,
yeah.
and there's something quite, you know, very strange about how much we're able to know each other's thoughts. How there's not really so much of a divide between us, mm-hmm. strangely, than we think.
Yep.
I actually wanted to tell a really strange story.
Go ahead, it's a ghost story.
Because it is kind of.
Yeah.
I wanted to see what you would think of this.
Probably scare the hell out of me.
Man, no, it's not really scary. I was with my mother when she died, and I was in a very small room. In this hospice, and she was lying in the bed, and I was on this small put-up bed next to her, and she'd kept saying to me, be asleep, go to sleep, darling, go to sleep. And I sensed that it was very private. I mean, I didn't know she was going to die in those next 4 hours, mm-hmm. but she just kept telling me that I should be unconscious of what was happening. And then I sort of had, and I was listening to her breathing, and I was aware of her breathing, and the window was open, there was this breeze coming in, and I had these kinds of images in my head of somehow some activity, some exchange, like a particle exchange, or like a sort of palpable density of some sort of energetic presence mm-hmm. going on in the room. But I was also, it was about 2 a.m, and I was tired, and I went into this kind of what must have been a sleep. And suddenly I was woken up out of my sleep by her saying, calling to me, going, darling, quick, look! And I sat up in the bed like this, and I saw her suspended, like 4 foot above the foot of my bed, wearing the nightdress that she was in, and she seemed to be being pulled from her shoulders, and she was going like this, as if saying, quick, this is fucking insane, you've got to see it. You know, and so I was there, and then that moment, exactly at that moment, the nurse walked in, and she saw me sitting like this, going, and she said, you know, what's happened? And I said, well, I think my mother's just passed away. So she quickly went up to her, and she felt her, and she said, no, 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 she's very warm still. She's very warm. And she went back, she got a stethoscope. And she said, yes, your mother has just passed away. She's just passed away. So it was extraordinary how there was, between the three of us, some kind of relational...
Wait, you, your mother, and
And the nurse, because
right.
the nurse came in at that moment.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then I wondered, for ages, I thought, wow, I had a vision of my mother. But then I realized, actually, it was kind of like a Mannerist painting or some kind of religious painting from, you know, some sort of ascension.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then I thought, maybe I was actually having a sense of what was happening, that I could only create an image of it to wake myself up to it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And your images are not your own. They come into your head from culture as well.
Yeah,
as
exactly, yeah. exactly. So, but somehow, as one organism in proximity to another in this moment, there was a more understanding or communication or awareness. I just wondered if...
No. Well, I can, very tackily but reciprocally, I can swap you my "the last time I saw someone die" story. Perhaps it wasn't the last time you saw someone die. But weirdly enough, the last time I saw someone die was 2 days ago.
Really?
And it's in the weirdest... I just have... It's just a story, but it's very odd. But it's about the formality of death, the formalism of death, and the way we see it as part of culture. And yet, at the same time, it has this extraordinary effect. It just kind of, you know, death... I mean, it's very, very powerful. I went to the proms 2 days ago, weirdly enough, kind of guest of the BBC, sitting in the box, all very formal, glass of wine in my hand. And it's the Vienna Philharmonic playing a Haydn symphony he wrote in London, number 98, and then in the second half, Schubert. So just about a minute into the beginning of the first movement of the symphony, I become aware that at the other side of the Albert Hall, it's round, to the left of the stage as you look at it, very weirdly, almost in military precision, half of the front row of the second section get up and walk out. Just like as one, like robotic, boom. And I'm like, that's interesting. And then I notice that there are these two guys in green. So it's the front of a section, so there's like a half wall. And weirdly, I mean, I should contextualise it. I'm a paramedic, among other things, a paramedic in the Israeli army, so I have, you know, kind of tuned into these things. And it suddenly becomes clear to me that these two guys in green are doing CPR. Because I can see the head, you know, the torso bobbing from behind. But you can't see the person. And then I suddenly notice they've got a thing called an ambo, which is this thing that you squeeze to put breath in. And it's really weird because nobody else has noticed at all. The music is continuing. And so initially, I'm adrenalinized telling the story now. I was adrenalinized then. As a paramedic, my first thought was, shit, do I go and help? But then, well, there's already two of them there. It'll take me 20 minutes to get there around the outside of the hall. And so I thought, you know what? I've just got to take this as an experience. And suddenly it became almost cinematographic because there was this Haydn playing, there's this woman dying. In a movie, that's quite frequently done in, you know, like Full Metal Jacket or whatever, these scenes of extraordinary violence and drama, but with some quite calming classical music on top. And also it seemed, although it was the Vienna Philharmonic and the Passion, it was an extraordinarily British moment. Because in Italy... Or
it's
wherever,
very famous. Also, Hitchcock always staged deaths in theatre.
Well, it was just perfect in that respect. In Italy, you know, the whole of the section behind the CPR would have gone, Madonna, she's dying! You know? And actually, they were just sitting there, you know, as it were, in the music. First movement comes to an end. One of the paramedics grabs this woman around under the armpits, and the other grabs her feet, and they drag her out. She's clearly dead, right? I mean, she's been having CPR for, you know, a quarter of a Haydn, right? So that you don't come back... from that, really, or it's the very
scientific, 10%. Scientific measurement there.
And they take her out the side, and she's dead. That's it, you know. And the symphony continues, and that was the last time I saw someone die. So there was this really kind of weird sense of formality, of Britishness, of adrenaline, which again I'm getting now because there is something really weird and outside of everything about it. And also in the end, I suppose, quite beautiful. And if to die, I mean, you know, then to die.
Well, yeah, it's interesting. I mean. It reminds me, I went to see Tristan and Isolde at Glyndebourne the other day. Someone called me up and said, I've got a ticket. You know, I don't buy it. But I love going to Glyndebourne when I get these kind of last-minute invitations. And it's something very strange about this, the music unfolding and then these very elderly people leaving the room. Mm-hmm. You know, they're just suddenly, some old man gets up and he just leaves the auditorium and the music's continuing.
He's
probably going to pee, but for me, I thought like it was this strange exit, like to die.
Yeah. Something beautiful. Is that in your work much then, dying?
Well, I've got a great friend who's a psychoanalyst called Darian Leader, and he wanted to write a book about mourning. Mm-hmm. And he said that he went to sort of do some research in Borders or Waterstones and to see what was the sections on mourning and bereavement. And he said, in fact, there was nothing. There was very little on dying. There was very little. And then he said, but then I realized that, in fact, nearly all of the kind of creative work, the nonfiction, was really all about mourning and loss. So I think that, I mean, I question my impulse to document things because it's a way to create. Like, my films are very present tense. I want to make a document of something. It's a way to kind of resist, you know, the end of things, to preserve things, really, to preserve moments of time. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, I'm trying to kind of perpetuate things that move me.
I think the idea, you know, there's this phrase, murdering to dissect, right? So I think, you know, butterflies on pins. I think there's a tension sometimes, if we term briefly to answer, you know, the sense that science wants to dry things out and drain the life out of them in order to understand them.
Mm.
And certainly putting butterflies on pins is only a partial way of understanding their beauty.
Mm.
And I think perhaps also, isn't it the case that when you capture something in film, you must be flattening it in some sense?
Well, there's always the feeling, I always remember what Andy Warhol said about that he found photographs really sad because all the people in them are probably dead. You know, this idea that there is some feeling of a sort of living death mask that you're sort of creating, to be kind of always in that awareness, yeah, is a place that I feel I instinctively am.
We've got five more minutes. When you talked about the extent to which projects are in your head and how they develop over time, I guess I thought of two things. One was that's a bit like what it's like for me to be working on something as a scientist. That, you know, and there's this kind of weird idea, you know, this thing about scientific serendipity, you know, that the idea comes to you in a dream or something, or when you're playing tennis. And it seems to me, again, no more extraordinary that it should come to you there than in the lab. In fact, it would be weirder if it came to you in the lab, you know, if that shot came to you in the edit. Because then the whole of the front of your brain, I'm talking very loosely here, folks, not front, like physically.
How do you then as a scientist like regard your body in terms of, do you like walking is always very good for creating thinking, though? I mean,
I mean, I tend to do most of my thinking in the shower. I mean, I love having showers. We've just got a new bathroom put in and it's brilliant. And it's got this great shower. And I just love being in there for ages, you know, because that's me at work, kind of. I mean, you know, that's when I'm actually thinking with. And I sometimes kind of make sure that the kids are, you know, looked after before I get into the shower, so that I won't be interrupted, because that's actually, you know, if I get interrupted in the middle, that's my work day.
Well, that's one of the things that's really nice about working from home, is that I can go to sleep when I want to. I can kind of do things like do some housework and then play some material, and it becomes part of my awareness of it's not just limited to sitting in a cutting room in a desk, you know, somewhere in Soho.
What's work like?
It's more like, you know, I try to kind of get to know the material and, you know, and be aware of it and when I'm in other physical states.
But I think there's something odd about that. It's almost like kind of self-misdirection, right? Misdirection being the magical thing where you make something disappear by making somebody look at that hand while you put it in your pocket.
Yeah.
And I often think that, you know, to pull, as it were, the creative rabbit out of the hat, you have to distract yourself.
Yeah. So what are you not allowing then? What have you got to distract yourself from?
Well, I tend to work on more than one thing at once, and I guess implicitly there's a question for me. I can't imagine how you would work on more than one film at once, given how you're describing it. But for my life, I mean, you know, as a man, I'm, as it were, a father and, you know, a friend and a flirt and a scientist and a commissioner. And I'm always generally interested in the thing I'm not supposed to be doing. But because enough of them are things that I consider part of myself, right? I can always, whichever one it is I'm doing, it's still me. It's just not the thing I'm supposed to be doing.
So it's just a bit of perversity that's... Yeah. Necessary.
Well, I think necessary perversity is exactly right, right? Because I think that, you know, for me at least, and maybe there are people who just wake up in the morning and say, I'm going to write 10 pages of my novel now, and then they do it, and then they go to breakfast. But I find that, who was it? There was a quote in the paper, wasn't there? Some British Prime Minister who was also a novelist, and he would write for 3 hours every morning between sort of 5 and 8. And apparently when he, if you know, between 5 and 8, he finished one novel, right? Then he, you know, it was like 10 to 7, and he still got an hour and 10 minutes of writing to do. He would just write for an hour and 10 minutes, the beginning of the next one.
What were the novels like?
It was one. I don't remember.
What were the novels like?
Which British Prime Minister was a novelist? But, you know, so that is just, like, horrifying to me. Absolutely.
Yeah, disgusting. It's very alien to me, too. I mean, that's why it's just so interesting to me, just to bookend this, to know that this idea about movement and how our bodies are actually brains, and that we should really be... kind of enjoy that aspect of being in a body.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I always love the Rilke, the Duino elegies, where the spirits are, not that I'm a sort of new age kind of person in this, but he just, in a poetic sense, he creates this idea of the spirits looking down onto the people who are still in bodies, and they miss this physicality, they miss this material contact, sexuality, you know, this... I think all these things... as we are becoming increasingly so encouraged to be virtual, that actually, you know, it's an amazing thing to be in this, to be in a body.
I think necessary perversity is right. And I think that, you know, again, the lack of limit to who I am, in other words, that I am my mind, I am in my body, my body's in the world, my world is changing, that sense of being unable to detach myself from the inconveniences of bodies and careers and funding and lack of sleep or too much sleep, you know, that necessary friction, the friction between me at that moment and the thing outside me, is what keeps me going, right? I mean, if it were too lubricated, it would feel like nothing.
Yeah,
and I think to me, that's kind of the concern.
And do you have other scientists that you kind of have community conversations like this with, or?
Yeah. The interesting thing about scientific collaboration, which is different from, because loads of people work on films, right? But almost all of them have different titles, right? There aren't two producers, or perhaps there are, but there aren't two directors. There aren't two writers, there aren't two dolly grips, perhaps. Mm. I may be slightly wrong here. But scientists, the collaboration is much more peer-like.
Is conversation important in this? It's crucial. I mean,
essential. Mm. That's what we do. Sophie, it's been a pleasure. Yeah.